I think we'll get started. So this is Ted Levin, who's here to speak about his new book, America's Snake, The Rise and Fall of the Timber Rattlesnake. He has been a longtime friend of mine, and he's been in the classroom of many of the students that are sitting in here right now, talking about rattlesnakes both last year and this year. So anyway, the book is due out in May, I think. A little bit about Ted. He's an avid Yankees fan. Yes. But his favorite color is chlorophyll green. Nice color. What else? A Burroughs Award winner, which is the most prestigious natural history writing award you can get in the United States for his last book, Liquid Land. So if anybody's interested in natural history of the Everglades, that's a great read. So I'm
going to
just turn things over to you,
all right? Okay, good. Thanks, Jeanne. So what I thought I would do is I'm going to try to break this up into three unequal parts. First part is to give you a background of the timber rattlesnake. Second part will be to run through my first ever PowerPoint. So be prepared for anything technologically wrong, because it'll probably happen. And the third part is I will read some short passages from America's Snake. I fell in love with timber rattlesnakes at a pretty young age. My mom and dad took me to the Staten Island Zoo in New York City. I grew up on Long Island. And the Staten Island Zoo had a reptile curator named Carl Kaufeld. And he loved rattlesnakes, so he made it his business to display every one of the then known 28 species and about a dozen or so subspecies of rattlesnakes found in the New World. And it was like a postage stamp collection of rattlesnakes, and I was so excited when I saw it, particularly because one species, the timber rattlesnake, lives within 25 miles of New York City and still does. Lives within 10 miles of Boston and still does. Lives within 15 miles of Philadelphia and still does. Lives outside of Cincinnati, Chicago, Charleston, South Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia. It is the widest distributed rattlesnake in the eastern North America. It's a snake that evolved in the deciduous forests. It's a deciduous forest rattlesnake. And as I said, it's now one, there's 38 species now. 10 more species have been either split apart or discovered since I was a child. But rattlesnakes as a group evolved from a group of vipers in Western Europe. They spread over land bridges about 4 or 5 million years ago into the New World. And the rattlesnakes themselves evolved about 4 million years ago in the high plains of Mexico, which to this day still has the highest diversity of rattlesnakes anywhere in the world. There are no rattlesnakes in Australia, Africa, Asia, or Europe. They are all essentially Mexico and the United States, except for one species, the neotropical rattlesnake, which is here in Costa Rica and ranges south all the way to northern Argentina. Most of the rattlesnake species are desert grassland species, with one gigantic exception, this guy. This was the first snake encountered by the pilgrims when they landed on Plymouth Rock. It was the first reptile in the New World to be classified by Linnaeus. In 1758, a timber rattlesnake caught on Murray Hill in Manhattan — Manhattan once was wild, it's hard to believe, and it did have rattlesnakes — was sent to Stockholm, and Linnaeus classified it first reptile in the New World, and he gave it the name Crotalus or Crotalus for rattle, and Horridus. And Horridus has nothing to do with its temperament. It has to do with its raised scales. It has a keel on all the side scales and back scales, which enables it to move through rocky terrain pretty easily and have a lot of friction and be able to grip. But of course, if you didn't know that and you saw the word hardest, you would immediately think that this was a very extremely dangerous animal, which it isn't. The last person in the Northeast to die from the bite of a timber rattlesnake was in 1929. And he was the curator of reptiles and mammals at the Bronx Zoo. And he was on a collecting outing in the Ramapo Mountains near Suffern, New York. And he reached down to pick up one snake and was bitten by one that he didn't see. And back in those days, anti-venom was much harder to come by than it is today. He had to hike 5 miles down to a hospital in Suffern. And by the time he got there, he was quite debilitated, and he died the next morning. That is the last death in the Northeast. There hasn't been a person who died of a timber rattlesnake bite in Massachusetts since the 1700s. There's only been one recorded death in Vermont. That was also in the 1700s. None in Maine, none in New Hampshire, none in Rhode Island that I am aware of. These guys had a prominent place in early American history. Besides being the first reptile classified by Linnaeus, their symbol was used by Benjamin Franklin just after the French and Indian War to talk about unifying the then 8 colonies on the eastern seaboard to fight against King James taxes from England. And he drew a picture of a rattlesnake, chopped it into 8 pieces, and said, united we conquer, divided we fall. And he labeled each one of the segments with the initials of the colonies. During the Revolution, the yellow flag with a coiled rattlesnake that says, don't tread on me, it's called the Gadsden flag, that was an American Navy flag. It's now been preempted, unfortunately, by the Tea Party, but it has a history long before the Tea Party. And it was the flag of the American Navy. The head of the American Navy during the Revolution, John Paul Jones, in his dress naval outfit, he had embossed rattlesnake, brass rattlesnake buttons running up and down the front and across the lapels. They fell on hard times after that. They were found historically in 31 states. They're extinct in Delaware, Michigan, Maine, and Rhode Island. They died off in Rhode Island. The last timber rattlesnake was seen in 1970. Maine was just after the Civil War, and I'm not sure what the dates for the last ones in Michigan or Delaware were. They were found at one point up the Niagara River beyond the falls, about 40 miles, and just over the Vermont border on Mystic Mountain in southern Quebec. They're gone from Canada now, too. Their stronghold happens to still be Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia. And they are an absolutely beautiful snake. When I start showing these pictures, you'll see that they come in innumerable colors. Desert rattlesnakes tend to be light brown, beige, with banded patterns or diamond patterns to blend in with the naked desert soil. These guys can be golden yellow. They can be jet black. They can have 37 to 45 chevrons, blotches, or bands encircling their body, or none at all. And the bands can be bordered by yellow or white, and the bands themselves can be any shade of gray, brown, olive. So they come in a lot of colors. And further south, like this one on the cover, it has a dorsal stripe that goes all the way down the top of the body that's orange. It's such a beautiful snake that one of their reasons that they're struggling today is people collect them for pets. There was a man named Roy McGinnis. He had a TV show on the Animal Planet called Swamp Brothers. He just got arrested. He's off to jail for 18 months, fined $5,000. For illegally collecting and selling timber rattlesnakes from New York and Pennsylvania. They sell for as much as $400 on the black market in Europe, and there still is a black market in the United States. They're still purchased illegally in Chinatown in New York City for their gallbladders and their blood. They're also used for leather. They're not protected in a lot of states. In the Northeast, the states that they're still found in, like Vermont, New Hampshire, they're endangered in Massachusetts. But you get into the Carolinas, and there is no protection. It's open season 12 months a year. So they can be big. They can grow up to 5 feet. They can be as thick around as my forearm. And in the Northeast, what makes them so fascinating and separates them from all other species of rattlesnakes in the New World, except for the prairie rattlesnake, is that they hibernate communally. And when I mean communally, if you have an historic den that hasn't been pestered by people, you can get several hundred timber rattlesnakes in the den. And they tend to wake up when their body temperature gets into the upper 40s and 50s. They come up on the rock shelves and they bask for weeks at a time and slowly spread out into the surrounding forest. They are extremely predictable. They need to have rocks to sun themselves. They need to have rocks, shelter rocks, to get away from the heat. If they get too warm, they need to have rocks to shed. And the males need to know where these rocks are to track the females down. An entire hillside in the southern edge of the Appalachian Mountains, or in the foothills of the Adirondacks, or wherever they happen to have timber rattlesnakes, will be layered with trails, invisible to us, but totally readable by a timber rattlesnake. And these trails will be made by the last rattlesnake that passed by. They leave a fatty, waxy secretion, a pheromone trail, and the snakes are flicking their tongues out, reading the wind and reading the ground, and they know where everybody is. They can't get lost. They read the world with senses we can't even fathom. They have pits in their cheeks, which makes them pit vipers. And do you guys know what they do with those pits?
No.
What do they do with them?
They sense heat of the prey.
Yeah, they're able to visualize a color that we don't see, infrared. And the pits, it's wide on the outside. It's narrow on the inside, and between the wide cavity and the narrow cavity is a very thin membrane that's well endowed with blood vessels and nerves, and it can register the difference in heat of less than 1/100th of a degree centigrade. So a snake can tell a warm mouse against a cold background, or a mouse that's colder against a really hot background, like a desert, in the desert. The rocks behind it might be 100 degrees and the mouse itself might be 97 degrees. The snake can easily tell where the mouse is. They use their tongue to find where rodent trails are. They go to those rodent trails, they coil up, and they lay their chin over a branch or a rock or a stump, wherever the activity happens to be, and they'll wait with the patience of a saint. And they could be there for days. And they'll feel the footfalls of a small mammal, and if it's the middle of the night, they'll strike at the infrared image. If you plug up the pits of a rattlesnake, timber rattlesnake or any rattlesnake, its success rate at striking is greatly diminished, and on a dark night, it could drop to nearly zero. If you blindfold the snake and you unplug pits, their success rate is still about 80%. In other words, they can strike a mouse without using their eyes, but using the visual image they're getting off from infrared off of their pits. And it's layered on the image on the back of their retina they get from their eyes. They are quite myopic. I mean, they choose the most beautiful places to live in the Northeast, sweeping panoramas that they can't see, but I can see. But they're there because it faces south and southwest, and it has unobstructed heat coming in from the sun. So if I tell you guys, who's taken Mrs. Kornfeld's apes class? So if I tell you a timber rattlesnake's a case-selected species, what are you going to tell me? Case-selected species. Yeah?
We have very few young.
Very few young.
There's different aspects, but they're easy. They don't reproduce very
And what did Gil tell you about the Fair de Lance today when we were walking around? About how many young they have? So would you call that a case-selected species? Timber rattlesnakes have 6 to 14 young. And in the Northeast, in Georgia they might breed every other year. In the Northeast, in the foothills of the Adirondacks, where I monitor my populations, they breed, the females breed for the first time, age 7 might be young. Most breed age 9, 10, and 11. Some as late as age 13. They can live into their 40s. And likely, as time goes on, and snakes that were marked during the Carter administration are still found to be alive, because you just lift them up and read the markings on their belly scales that biologists from Skidmore have snipped into their tummies. They may live 70 or 80 years. Nobody knows yet. Nobody studied them quite that long. They breed once every 4 to 7 years. And their breeding cycle depends on the dropping of acorns in the Northeast. What do you think acorns might possibly have to do with timber rattlesnakes?
Squirrels.
Yeah, exactly. Mice, squirrels, chipmunks. We get a big mast year every 6 or 7 years in the Northeast. Lots of nuts drop. The next spring, lots of chipmunks are breeding, lots of white-footed mice are breeding. They're the two principal preys of timber rattlesnakes. So a population of white-footed mice per acre can go from 2 white-footed mice to 250 in a mast year. What that means is that snakes will be much more successful the year after the acorns drop eating. And when they do, they're putting on a lot of fat, and they get follicular development of the unfertilized eggs, and they are then ripe for mating. The males track them down. They can smell the pheromones. They wait till the female sheds. They court. Mating can last hours, if not most of a day. They then will drop the eggs, and the eggs won't be fertilized until the following spring. Once they come out of hibernation in late April, early May, they will try to feed and shed. They will go to their birthing sites, their rookery sites. They will bask for up to 90 days. They try to keep their body temperature between 85 and 92 for as long as possible. The earlier they drop their young, they give live birth. Eggs hatch inside them. They're ovoviviparous. The more they can warm up, the sooner they can give birth, the sooner they may be able to get a meal before they go to bed for the winter, which could be the difference between living and not living over the winter if it's a long, long winter. They will have 6 to 14 young. The mom stays with the babies, protects them for up to 2 weeks until they shed. Then she either goes off and hunts or she goes back to the den to go to sleep, and they just follow her. They follow her pheromone trail. And they go back to the den. So the rattlesnake demography depends on the success of females and the survival of females. Rattlesnake health and genetics of a den depends on males, because males wander. They go up to 5 miles, and they can mate. About a third of all matings and pairings take place from a male from one den with a female from another den. And that keeps the dens viable and healthy. Cars are probably the biggest interrupting force in the Northeast for healthy dens, because they keep the males from crossing the roads. Males do not do well with roads. Where there are timber rattlesnakes in fair numbers near urban areas, there tends to be less incidence of Lyme disease, because the reservoir host for Lyme disease is the two biggest reservoir hosts are chipmunks and white-footed mice. White-footed mice is the biggest. Those are the two most important food sources for timber rattlesnakes in the Northeast. They also eat lots of shrews, which is also another reservoir host. So in towns like Glastonbury, Connecticut, on the east side of the Connecticut River across from Hartford, Connecticut, you tend to have less incidence of Lyme disease per capita than you do in towns next door to Glastonbury that don't have rattlesnakes. And that's principally because of the rattlesnake's diet. It's one of many things that can dampen the outbreak of Lyme disease just by what they eat. And areas that have a healthy population of hawks and owls, snakes, besides rattlesnakes like rat snakes and milk snakes that feed on these same things, you tend to get less incidence of Lyme disease. Okay, let me give it a shot at what do I do, Jeannie? I should do it. If I do it from this side, I won't be touching it. I won't be standing in front of it, right? Okay, this is a yellow morph. Most people who study rattlesnakes talk about different morphs. There's a dark morph and a light morph. Yellow morph has a yellowish head, and I've seen ones that are golden yellow and with chocolate-colored bands. They're breathtaking. As breathtaking as any bird we saw today. Really. Pit vipers, and this shouldn't just be say venomous, it should be saying vipers and pit vipers. They have a triangular-shaped head because their venom glands are contained over here. This separates a rattlesnake from all other snakes on the planet. Every time they shed, they get a new segment. So this doesn't necessarily mean how old the snake is, because they shed based on how much they eat. They eat a lot, they might shed 3 or 4 times in a year, and they get 3 or 4 new segments. Plus, segments break off. I had a friend that marked a rattlesnake, and he was carrying it, driving home, carrying it in his arm, driving with one hand, and the rattle broke off. They break off pretty easy, and you can put them back on like Snap-on beads. And it fell under his seat, and he couldn't find it right off the bat. So yeah, he marked the snake, returned it. About a year later, he caught the snake. He had since found the rattle, put it in a baby jar where he put all his other broken rattles, brought it back like Cinderella, and he fit each one of the rattles until he found the snake's right rattle, put it back on, and let it go. And the rattle forms from a thickened bit of skin at the end of the tail that doesn't shed because it's constricted right here. And when the snake sheds its skin, it just moves back one row. And it's completely hollow. It's got 3 segments, and they'd shake inside the segments. And if we could run, if we could use oxygen as efficiently in a marathon race as a rattlesnake uses in its shaker muscles to shake its rattle, we could run marathons in under 9 minutes.
What?
Everything about a rattlesnake is a type B personality, except 2 things: the speed of the strike and the shaking of the rattle. How do I play that?
It's not
loud enough.
You need speakers.
Okay, well, here's another one. There's your pit. So inside this pit, there's a very thin membrane that can register heat and sends the message of the difference in the heat from the surrounding area back to the optical nerve, and gets a superimposed image gets put on the back of the retina. And what's interesting is that biologists believe that the evolution of the pit was not to find food at first, but was to find a place to get out of the desert sun. So it reads the world with those twin tines, and those tines move in counterclockwise areas, and they spin odor particles that adhere to the tongue, pulls it into the mouth, deposits the odor particles on the floor of its mouth, and when it closes its mouth, it has an organ on the roof of the mouth called the vomer nasal organ, or Jacobson's organ, and that interprets the messages of the odor. It's a long tubular body plan. One long, only the heart you would recognize as a heart. Everything else is really stretched out. just giving you an idea of different colors and patterns. So this is a historic distribution of timber rattlesnakes in the United States and Southern Canada. Red is extirpated. Green is extant. But what this doesn't show you is that even a lot of the extant areas, the numbers are dwindling. There are 29 different ecotypes. No subspecies. It's one solid species, Crotalus horridus. Not broken into subspecies, but everywhere here, it's an ecotype that has evolved to the particular areas that they happen to live in. For instance, I grew up on Long Island. Last rattlesnake on Long Island was seen in 1962. On Long Island, they don't hibernate communally. There are no rock piles. They go into sphagnum bogs and go just below waterline. You know, their bodies could be submerged, and maybe one or two would be in one spot. And they behave the same way in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey. This is a rock den, a crevice den. They have to get below the frost line. They can't live somewhere in the Northeast where they can't get below the frost line. This is a snake waking up and moving up through a talus slope below a big cliff. That's another principal denning area. These snakes are on the bluff in Minnesota above the Mississippi River. That's sandstone. Again, that they have to be able to get below the frost line to live there. That's why they're not uniformly found at the northern end of their distribution. Another idea of color patterns. And there's that image that Benjamin Franklin put together. People work very hard at eradicating them, and one of the ways they used to eradicate timber rattlesnakes was releasing hogs. They just eat them. They have so much fat that when they get bitten, they have no effect. This is one of Audubon's most famous images from the birds of North America. But sad to report two things. He was a much better observer of birds than he was of rattlesnakes. For instance, timber rattlesnakes have vertically slashed pupils. They're the eyes of night hunters, like cats. He's got a round pupil in his snake. Timber rattlesnakes have two teeth on the maxilla, the upper jawbone. He's got a whole row of them up here. And they do eat birds, but they rarely climb trees to feed on birds. These are two, they call them canebrake rattlesnakes in the Southeast. Two that were butchered and opened up, and the babies are out. Well, yeah. This is a biologist, Henry Laramie. This picture was taken in the early 70s. People were going up to a hill south of Concord called Pinckney Hill in New Hampshire, and they were slaughtering the rattlesnakes. So he decided he would go on a mission of mercy, and he collected the last 10 he could find. That's a potato fork harvesting potatoes, put them in a wooden crate. He donated them all to the Boston Museum of Science at Swan Lake Science Center. These are the tanned hides of timber rattlesnakes. They're beautiful, but they look more attractive on the snake themselves. These are two males in a combat dance. If two males are attracted to the same, males mate every year, surprise, surprise. And when they two find the same female, they will wrap around each other and go back and forth. Usually it's the bigger snake wins. It's like disembodied arm wrestling. This is mating. This yellow morph is a male, the black morph is a female. Snakes have a two-pronged penis called a hemipenes. And it has all these accoutrements attached on it, prongs and fleshy projections. And when they fill it up with blood, they inflate it like a balloon, they put it inside the female, and I know this is a female because you see how it's swollen there? Let's see. See how this is swollen? So the scales are spreading apart? That's because the hemipenes is in there. And they stay locked together. They can stay together for more than 20 hours mating. And the hemipenes lock the male inside. And when the female decides she's had enough, she just leaves and drags him along by the hemipenes. And eventually the blood drains out and he falls off. This is a baby. This is the amniotic sac. The shell is not here. This is the same sac when you crack an egg open, you see that little transparent membrane? This is that same transparent membrane. Reptiles were the first of the vertebrates with an amniotic sac. The Orion Society exists. They're in Georgia. That's where we do our March intensives every other year for some of you that have been there.
Conti has been, and Julie, and who else? And Madeline,
They believe it takes 20 years to replace one female. And on the black market, people know these snakes don't breed in random spots. If you study snakes, I can bring people up there and I say, okay, let's go over to this rock and take a look, and there'll be a snake there because that rock has special benefit to the snake. It has, and this rock doesn't, and this rock does. Give you an idea of the distribution in New Jersey. It's becoming more and more disjunct. And you can just imagine, this is the Pine Barrens. There's roads all over the place in here. And roads are the male's undoing because when they feel the vibration of a truck or a car, they freeze and coil up. And it only takes one ophidiophobic driver who hates snakes to go out of his way to run it over, and that'll be the end of that snake. This is a distribution in New York, also disjunct. This is a biologist holding a snake in place so he can get all of his equipment, and he clips the scales, and the oldest snake, this is Bill Brown from Skidmore, the oldest snake he marked was born the summer the Beatles released Hey Jude, 1969. These are the hollow fangs, and the maxilla bone, there's one fang per bone, and this is a replacement fang next to it. When a rattlesnake strikes, the maxilla rolls out. So when it closes its mouth, the teeth are folded back in, which is different than your coral snakes. The teeth are fixed in place. This is the ambush pose, waiting to feel the vibrations of a chipmunk. This is the chipmunk about to get bitten. Generally, they swallow head first. I should say that Alexander Westrich drew all these pictures. These are illustrations from my book. That's an unfortunate dog that got a little too close to a timber rattlesnake. But it healed. Their principal diurnal predator are red-tailed hawks. And red-tailed hawks, I told you rattlesnakes are predictable. Well, I wasn't the only one to learn this. Hawks know this. And they hang out at these sites where rattlesnakes are basking and rattlesnakes give birth. And they bring the young hawks there, and the mothers will show them how to swoop down and try to catch a snake. Not that they do it all the time. Black racers, Calubra constrictor, black snake, principal predator on baby rattlesnakes. They know where the mother rattlesnakes give birth, and they start showing up in late July, early August, waiting for the mothers to give birth. They have very long teeth. They're not venomous, but what they'll do is they'll bite four or five neonates right in a row to disable them, then they'll go back and start feeding on the disabled babies. This is a principal nocturnal predator, great horned owl. And this is a snake suffering from snake fungal disease, Ophidiomyces ophidiodicola. It is doing to timber rattlesnakes in the Northeast what white nose syndrome is doing to bats. It's yet another problem they're having to deal with. And no one knows whether the soil fungus that causes this is native, whether it's come from snake breeding facilities and got loose in the wild, whether it's been brought on by the abnormal weather changes we've been having with global warming, making winters wetter and not quite as cold. But it's a great big issue. And you can imagine how difficult it is to try to convince a state to appropriate money for a snake disease, particularly a venomous snake disease. These are two intrepid rattlesnake biologists. These guys have been working on rattlesnakes since the late 1950s, early 1960s, particularly Marty Martin that's up on top. This man, Bill Brown, has the longest single study of any reptile species in the world going. He's into his 44th year. And this is a group of biologists that get together. They're called the Bashers. They get together for 4 days every September to talk about rattlesnakes in their particular areas, timber rattlesnakes. And they go on field trips, and they drink a lot of beer and have a great time. But largely, timber rattlesnakes are existing because of these guys, at least in the Northeast. The Long Island Railroad did in timber rattlesnakes in Long Island because the snakes, sadly, would come up on the cinder blocks to bask. And if they didn't get run over outright by the commuter trains, they were whacked by people that walked the rails looking for pins that have come out. These are the Pentecostal snake handlers. It's still legal to dance with snakes in West Virginia. Last two people in the United States to be killed by timber rattlesnakes was 2010 and 2014. Both were ministers of the Pentecostal Church, snake handling settlement, because they don't seek medical attention. He's got 11 diamondback rattlesnakes in his mouth. I mean, you couldn't do this with bluebirds or bellbirds. I mean, nobody would stand for it.
Are they clipped?
No.
No.
He also has a Guinness Book of World Record for getting into a bathtub with rattlesnakes. I think it's 99, and into a sleeping bag with rattlesnakes.
Why?
He just doesn't get bitten. Well, he actually has lost a limb. He has gotten bitten, I should say. He lost an arm. There's something, you guys know what a rattlesnake roundup is?
Yeah.
I was sent down by Natural Resources Defense Council about 8 years ago to write a story for their magazine, On Earth, about the Sweetwater, Texas roundup. And we used to do this to timber rattlesnakes in the 1800s in the Northeast, kill them by the hundreds, if not thousands. In Sweetwater, Texas, people come in and they get prizes for bringing in the most snakes, the heaviest snakes. Formerly, they got a prize for the smallest snake. And people have put shotgun pellets down the snakes so they weigh more.
Oh.
And then you can pay $5 and you can cut the head of the rattlesnake off with a machete. Have your picture taken. You could put your hand in the blood from your snake, put it up on a wall board, and sign your name and where you're from. And believe me, there's no shortage of people lining up to do this. And it's you couldn't do this with any other animal in the United States and get away with it. So this is a snake basking before it goes to bed, soaking up the sunshine. And this is the last snake. So can you guys get antsy?
No.
Okay. I'm going to read a couple. Is this here for me?
It's for you. Yep.
Oh, thank you.
Would you like me to bring the podium?
Yeah, it would make it easier for me. Thanks. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah, Jamie.
Yeah, I was wondering where and how you studied the snakes.
Well, I can't tell you where, and that's something I haven't talked much about. But biologists, the 6 years I worked on this book, I was shown snakes I can't describe. I was taken to places I can't talk about. And I saw numbers of snakes I can't reveal. And it's because people either go there to kill them, they go there to catch them and sell them, or if too many people go and try to handle them, they get really riled up. And even places that are heavily studied by biologists, if you're handling the snakes and marking them, they respond to you the way they would respond to a predator, which means when you put it down, they're going to freak out and go under the rocks and get away, and they will change their behavior. They won't bask as much. They'll bask in less favorable places. So it's very difficult. I would love to take people to see them. You don't know how much I would love to take a field trip with people to see them, but it's hard. This is the uncorrected page proofs, which essentially means this is what the book looks like before it's actually made into a book. This goes out for first reviews and for magazines for first serials. So there are typos in here. So if you hear me fumbling around, it's probably because I'm reading over a typo and freaking out. Okay. One unbearably humid afternoon last June, after 12 straight days of rain and periodic flash floods, Alcott Smith and I visited a talus slope at our undisclosed site in the northeast. Nothing on the rock pile was stable, certainly not the trees rooted in the thin soil at the base of the cliff, many of which had already toppled and lay crisscrossed like pickup sticks or leaned at precarious angles and seemed ready to fall at the slightest provocation. Walking along the upper talus, a mile from our car, at an incline 6 times steeper than a ramp for the disabled, Alcott dislodged a rogue boulder the size of a Volkswagen that smashed downhill 40 or 50 yards, transmitting a vibratory message to every rattlesnake within the immediate rock field, the very snakes we hoped not to startle, and sobering us as no snake ever had. Once the boulder settled in place, the thick, stale air reeked, a flinty, gunpowdery smell, the byproduct of intense frictional heat as ground rock against ground rock. Now, whenever we cross the talus, we go single file like first graders on a field trip. The only difference is we don't hold hands. Horizontal baby steps, never vertical. On talus, I strive to keep my balance and watch for rattlesnakes, often simultaneously. It's not easy. Imagine a skirt of fractured rocks that begins at the foot of a cliff and slopes to ground, which may be 200 yards away if the cliff rises 1,300 feet high. A desolation of boulders, a million rocks that peeled away from the precipice, each breaking apart as it tumbled down. It's all about weathering and gravity. The most massive tend to accumulate farthest from the source. Many tons of once out of control, spark spraying boulders, some as big as Buicks, bouncing downhill that eventually wedge against conspecifics where they may remain until the end of time. When a glacier gives birth to an iceberg, we call the process calving. But I know of no comparable term for the birth of a boulder. There ought to be, for the process must be louder, longer, and more odoriferous, and more destructive, unless, of course, you were a passenger on the Titanic. I've never witnessed a cliff-shedding rock, but I imagine it must be formidable. Smaller, lighter rocks collect higher up the slope, having either chipped off tumbling boulders or fallen directly from the cliff, splattering like pieces of broken ceramic. Older, larger rocks, those settled in place for centuries or longer, are weathered smoother, carpeted with lichen and moss, and stable to walk on, though you wouldn't want to fall into one of the unforgiving spaces between them. Boulders at the bottom of the pile are embedded in the earth, which must dimple under their great weight. More recent additions to the rock pile are sharp-sided, barren, and unstable to walk on, particularly if the rocks are small. Hiking across a small talus is like hiking across a slanted field of seesaws or up a mound of stony boxes. Any misstep may trigger an avalanche. rain, particularly torrential downpours, cause talus walking to be edgy. Rocks are slick and unstable, water having washed away wherever the soil that had helped to bind them. So that gives you an idea of some of the places, what some of these places in the Northeast are like with the snake's den. They leave these areas and go off into the forest for 4 or 5 months to feed. But they come back to these places to den, to mate, and to shed. You guys know where Glastonbury is? Glastonbury, Connecticut? Okay. This is from a chapter called Among Rattlesnakes, and it's how this community has not only learned to live with them, they cherish their snakes, most people. Your second SAT question of the book, and I promise there's only two, reads, ecology is to blank as hydrology is to water. The only acceptable answer would be relationships. That is, the constellation of relationships between members of the same gene pool and relationships between the various species that live within the same biologic neighborhood. The study of ecology includes the relationships of each species to the inorganic aspects of the world around them. Because living things have meaning in terms of what they do, I want to know, and since you've gotten this far into the book, I assume you want to know, what does a rattlesnake mean? That well-muscled 4-foot snake, the color of fallen leaves, and patterned in sunlight and shadow, mobilized in loops and coils, hidden in plain sight, his chin resting on a fallen limb with saintly patience, a spring-loaded bomb waiting to be triggered by an infrared signal? What is the meaning of life lived in the emptiness beyond our senses? In his poem Amongst Schoolchildren, William Butler Yeats asks, how can we know the dancer from the dance? Had Yeats' poem been titled Among Rattlesnakes, the text could have taken a different turn, but the essence would have remained the same. A timber rattlesnake and its dance, sometimes gradual, sometimes sudden, are inseparable, a union forged in the fires of natural selection, shaped by the cyclical comings and goings of glaciers, that first isolated the snakes in shrinking refuges in the deep south and then later liberated them to spread northward into inhospitable woodlands, draining and then refilling gene pools, shaped also by the piling of rocks at the base of exfoliating cliffs, by the nature of the seasons and the fickleness of weather, and by the aura every species that ever lived besides them, from mastodons to meadow voles. What does a timber rattlesnake mean to an eastern deciduous forest, or to the talus, or to the white-footed mouse, or the hungry red-tailed hawk that hangs on a draft above the gestating sites, its wings as level as Nebraska? What precisely does a rattlesnake mean to you? Is it a venomous echo from the book of Genesis, an unhinged reptile that escaped notice when God breathed life into the charred void? Or is it a traveler, an evolutionary passenger emerging from the mist of deep time on a singular journey of survival, procreation, and change, trimmed in the crucible of time, and in due time eliminated? How would the herpetologist answer that question? The hiker, the turkey hunter, the herpetoculturist, the poacher, the snake handler, the philanthropist who seeks to protect the fracturing habitats of reptiles and amphibians, or the motorist who runs snakes over, or the outdoorsman who kills them out of ignorance, malice, and spite? How about a westbound Hartford commuter who crosses the Connecticut River on the Bulkley Bridge from his or her residence in Glastonbury, where for perhaps 8,000 years rattlesnakes egress down a shoulder of a nearby mountain, down nameless creases in the bedrock now called Laurel Grove Road and Bower Pond Lane, where realtors are compelled to tell prospective homebuyers that every summer timber rattlesnakes may cross their driveway, bask in their garden, or copulate on the front lawn in an act of self-absorption that lasts all day. Okay, got one more somewhere. Okay. Testosterone is a hormone produced mainly in the testes. Oh, this is such a great quote, I just have to read it. It's, every one of the chapters opens with a quote I think is appropriate for the chapter. And what I should have done is read the quote that opens the book. It's really great. There's do you guys know who Edward Abbey is?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he had a colleague who just passed away this past year named Charles Bowden, who was a really, really good writer as well. And Charles Bowden had this to say. He said, "For our kind, rattlesnakes are coiled, tail vibrating, fangs at the ready to poison us. It's as if we formed our entire knowledge of automobiles from head-on collisions." Okay, so this is a quote that's opening a chapter, chapter 7. It's called "The Dangers of Being Male." And it's, you guys know who Casey Stengel is? He was a longtime manager of the New York Yankees, perhaps one of the most famous managers in Major League Baseball history. And he said in the 1950s, "Being with a woman all night never hurt no professional baseball player. It's staying up all night looking for a woman that does them in." Okay, testosterone is a hormone produced mainly in the testes, a mind-numbing internal drug that alters consciousness, skews judgment, and urges men into unguarded realms. When testosterone levels are high, behavior considered normal degenerates into a single-minded quest for sex. It should come as no surprise to anyone who has kept a pet that human males are not alone here. We belong to a long roster of evolutionary cohorts. Offhand, I can't think of a species in the animal kingdom in which the male doesn't abandon all sense of decorum during the breeding cycle. Think stallion, buck, boar, rooster, alligator, and so forth. During an undeviated search to mate, the male lowers his guard, you might say behaves inappropriately, stops eating, stops sleeping, and often engages in ritualistic combat, all of which collectively deplete vital stores of energy. For the human male, carnal behavior peaks in the 20s and then fades with the passage of time. For an old male timber rattlesnake, however, decrepit is not part of the game plan. And only death trumps the libido, which may percolate for more than 40 years. And for the rattlesnake, the annual arousal may lead to death, particularly when a road is involved. Shortly after graduating from college, I took a job in the education department at the Bronx Zoo. 6 months later, I accepted the zoo's generous offer to enroll in a night course in mammalogy taught at Hofstra University. The course was so much fun, I joined the American Society of Mammalogists and attended the 1972 annual meeting at Busch Gardens, both on the zoo's nickel. On my way home from Tampa, I detoured around southern Georgia, hoping to see a large snake, any species, indigo, eastern diamondback, coach rip, yellow rat. I wasn't fussy. After several hours of cruising, I spotted an adult diamondback, Gargantua of the rattlesnake clan, emerging from a bouquet of palmettos. I pulled over, got out of my car, and watched the big snake move, slowly and deliberately in a straight line like a venomous caterpillar. The diamondback took the shortest route to my side of the road, perpendicular to the flow of traffic, had there been a flow. By the time the first car appeared, the snake had nearly reached the far shoulder. Unfortunately, the driver, an ophidiophobe, veered to my side, struck the snake 20 feet in front of me, and then looped back, having ignobly transformed a 5-foot rattlesnake with a head the size of a softball into dead snake crawling, its innards spilling out. Several years later, now employed at Cumberland Gap National Historic Site on the border of Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee, I was a seasonal naturalist among a staff of history buffs. Here in rural Appalachia, I met two types of people. Those who killed those like the Georgia driver who killed snakes quickly and those who killed snakes slowly, collecting them for a local and illegal Pentecostal snake handling sect, the very same ones that eventually sponsored the Wofords. These are people I wrote about earlier in the book that were snake handlers that died of snake bites, a father and a son, whose death by snake bites would one day be covered by the national media. Mac Ray in 1983 and his son Mac Randall in 2012, right here in Middleboro, Kentucky, gateway to Cumberland Gap. Both types of snake species people could be found at the National Historic Site in Cumberland Gap. One evening, as I followed a park ranger over Pinnacle Road, a male timber rattlesnake on a mating mission slithered out of the woods and onto the edge of the road. The ranger stopped, opened his door, and shot the snake, and then escorted me to the campground where he introduced my talk on local wildlife. The Wall Street Journal called David Shepard's research the old rubber snake trick. Place a fake snake where people are sure to see it and then record what happens when they see it. People in this case were Louisiana motorists, and Shepard, a professor at Southeast Louisiana State University with an academic interest in herpetology and Cajun driving habits, wanted to quantify intentional kill behavior of his neighbors. Shepard also deployed a rubber turtle to see if drivers had a preference for what they liked to hit. Shepard and his students placed their toys on the highway, hid in nearby bushes, and then watched cars go by. You can replicate the study yourself. It's not quantum physics. But why bother? Very likely your results wouldn't deviate from Shepard's, which illuminated two universal truths. First, snakes evoke a dark pathology in otherwise normal people. And second, that for snakes, crossing a road is risky business. Over the course of 3 years, 22,000 motorists approached the fake reptiles, which were alternately placed mid-lane on the double yellow line or on the shoulder. Although 87% of the drivers tried to avoid contact, of the 12,420 vehicles that passed the snake, 1,281, 10.3%, hit it. Of those, 498, nearly 40%, deviated from their path to make contact, nearly triple the number that deliberately struck the turtle. Some drivers ratcheted the intentional kill behavior to another level. 11 motorists struck the model more than once, including a housewife who drove over it 6 times. One man hit it, backed his car up until the rear tire was on the snake's head and then peeled out. A sheriff struck the snake in the breakdown lane, backed over it, then got out of a squad car, gun drawn, before Shepard stepped out from the bushes like the host of Candid Camera and told the officer about his research. Several drivers, including the operator of a tractor trailer, who crossed to the opposite shoulder, risked head-on collision to make contact with the model. Some people, Shepard concluded, just have a mean streak. Building on Shepard's research, a team from Butler Community College in El Dorado, Kansas, set out to determine what was more provocative to a motorist, snake shape or snake color. The students ultimately placed a black rubber snake, a neon blue rubber snake, and a straight section of black hose at various spots on well-traveled road, parallel to the traffic, to minimize accidental hits. Like Shepard, they hid behind the roadside bushes. Each trial ran separately and lasted 10 minutes or until the target was hit. On the double yellow line, the black model was hit in 22 out of 21 trials, and the rubber hose was hit in 3 out of 20 trials.
22 out of how many trials?
21 out of 21 trials. And the rubber hose was hit in 3 out of 20 trials. And the lapse of time between the placement and strike was nearly 3 times longer for the hose than for the snake. More than twice as many cars passed the hose before first contact. In each trial, the Dayglow blue snake provided a more attractive target than the hose, nearly as attractive as a more authentic-looking black model. When placed mid-lane, the black snake, the blue one that wasn't used for this trial, was by far the more popular than the hose. The upshot of the study, no matter what the color, If it's shaped like a snake, it's more likely to be struck by a motorist. The Jayhawkers then sorted the contact vehicles into two categories, truck drivers and non-truck drivers, with pickup trucks included in the latter category. That's the non-truck driver category. Although eight times as many truck drivers used the road, truck drivers made 60% of the strikes. The conclusion, the better line of sight for the non-truck drivers by virtue of their height above the roadway, the truck drivers were more likely to run over the snake on the road, whether because they were bored, congenitally cruel, or woefully ignorant, or some combination of the three. To conclude the project, the team administered a questionnaire to the Butler Community College students, which revealed that 13% of male respondents, 25 out of 193, and 4% of female respondents, 7 out of 171, had deliberately hit a snake crossing the road, more than double that had reported hitting a snake accidentally. Not all species of snakes cross roads at the same pace. A black racer, for instance, boogies nonstop. The speed of a timber rattlesnake crossing the road is akin to that of leaves unfurling on a twig, barely noticeable. Which brings us to the premise of this chapter. Why would a thick-set, methodical timber rattlesnake cross the road? And you already know the answer, don't you? Okay, that's it. So I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Do all like endangered species that get this kind of attention, or is it sort of like a large? Because you were, I saw, we were talking about the bachers, or is there like a large foundation for the timber rattlesnakes?
No. And it's surprising that timber rattlesnakes are getting this attention. It's really because of these dedicated biologists. Some endangered species hardly get any public attention. But these guys are there, and they're the last of a long legion of iconic predators in the Northeast. Mountain lions are gone, lynx are gone, wolves are gone. They're still there, and surprisingly close to humanity. And that's because they're not aggressive. I had a friend inadvertently stand on one, and the snake could have bit him in the back of the leg, and instead was hitting him with the side of his head as if to say, excuse me, to get him to lift his leg up. And when they bite, they can meter their venom. They can choose not to release any venom at all or release it in one fang or both fangs. 25 to 40% of all bites, no venom is released. And another 40%, well, I should make that 60% of all bites happen on the arms, which means you're interacting with the snake purposely. Sure. The 40% of the bites that happen on the legs is your bushwhacking didn't see it. Those are legitimate bites.
Are there any in your Hanover?
No. They used to be. They used to be on Little Escutney Mountain. They used to be on Skitchewog Mountain in Springfield, Vermont. When they built I-91, they dynamited Skitchewog, where the snake dens were, to get the rock for fill for the interstate to put the macadam on. They used to be, you know where the Fairley Diner is?
Yeah.
You know the Fairley Cliffs? The talus slopes below the Fairley Cliffs had snakes 100 years ago. They were on Cottonstone Mountain in Orford until the 1950s. So they used to be there. When I went to graduate school, there were still rattlesnakes on Wantasiket, which is just south of Keene, across from Brattleboro. They're gone now, too, since 1980.
I'll tell my story of a hike I took with a timber rattler, Pennsylvania Rainbow Gathering. Thousands of people camped in the National Forest, and there were timber rattlers in this environment, and there was one on the trail. People didn't know what to do with it, and I had a 5-foot stick, and I just guided it along into the woods and up into the rocks where nobody could camp. about 150 feet probably. It was very well behaved.
Yeah.
I would, maybe one time I pushed it off in a way it didn't quite want to go, and it made a small rattle, but mostly it just followed my lead and kept going calmly and went into the woods. That same gathering, one of the leaders of Kid Village, Felipe, an Indian, and was bit, and he had to be evacuated out. Had quite an experience.
Where was he bit? Where was he bit?
I don't remember, but he was. I think he was in, up on the hill where the he had the camp for the kids. But I don't remember where. And I didn't see that, but they had to get a helicopter and take him out.
Yeah, they're really not aggressive. My kids have grown up going in the field with me to watch them. I mean, you guys know Jordan, right?
Yeah.
Some of you. Yeah, I've been taking him out looking at rattlesnakes since he was 5 and 6 years old. Yeah.
Why? You said that the gallbladders were like a hit on the black market. Why is that?
A lot of Oriental cultures think of them as a medicinal,
okay.
Have a medicinal use.
Same as rhino horn.
Tiger.
The
tiger
blood.
Pardon me?
Oh, yeah. What about the blood?
Cook with it, put it in different dishes.
What would you put that with?
I have no idea.
So
I think it was fish.
Oh.
Yeah.
During the presentation, you mentioned it came from rattlesnakes, but I'm not sure if those are the same thing as a timber rattlesnake, or are they different?
The,
it looks like
cave rattlesnake?
Cane.
Oh, canebrake.
Okay.
It's what they call timber rattlesnakes on the Piedmont and the coast of the southeast. Same species. It used to be thought of as a different species, and it was thought of as a subspecies.
Mm-hmm.
But the Human Genome Project that was completed?
Yeah.
But that's revolutionizing taxonomy among animals. And they realized canebrakes and timber rattlesnakes are not only not different subspecies, they're exactly the same subspecies. Yeah, Jamie.
I'm just wondering, you said there are no like subspecies of the timber rattlesnake, but you said there were 29 different ecotypes, and I'm just wondering what the difference between the different types of subspecies.
Well, subspecies would be genetically more different than an ecotype. An ecotype could be thought of as something evolving over due time to become a subspecies. But these guys were subjected to the Pleistocene glaciers coming down in the northeast 4 times in a couple million years. And when it pushes them together, it's all pushing all these ecotypes together in one refuge. And they're all breeding again and mixing up, and then they start all over again. So they would have to be left separately without anything like a glacier interrupting their evolution for several million years. And some of these ecotypes might become subspecies, if not species. It's an early step in the way to becoming a species. Yeah, Emily.
How many species of rattlesnakes are there?
It's in the 30s. And when I first was learning about them, it was 28. But it's all this new taxonomy looking at DNA. It's rapidly changing, not only rattlesnakes, but lots of things. Yeah?
What are you doing when you track the snakes? Like, are you putting a chip in them? Or are you like...
I don't touch them.
You don't touch them?
Nope.
Okay, you're just counting the population?
I count them. I look at them. I identify them if I can.
Yeah.
But I travel with biologists who handle them. Yeah, I'm a guy that goes from project to project, and it's long-term projects. This was 6 years, and I'll move on to something else. But they do. They either put microchips in them so they can wave a wand over it, and they knew who the snake is. Or Bill Brown, he has a numerical system for clipping little pieces of the ventral scales, and he can find a snake skin shed. And he can look at the skin and look at the belly of the skin and read the number, know who that snake is, even if he hasn't seen it in 10 years, because he has them all cataloged and computerized.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Was there anything that surprised you like a lot during your 6 years?
Yeah. The biggest thing that surprised me is how protective biologists were about the snakes. And, you know, Mrs. Kornfeld can tell you, because she was with me most of the summer when I was fielding phone calls from irate biologists freaking out that I was going to give away all their trade secrets where all their research was. Because I really didn't get into the whole poaching aspect, but people had made careers tormenting biologists, stealing their snakes, and leaving them notes tacked in trees. A lot of that's in the book, but it's a real problem. And people collect them for pets. They're really easy to keep in a cage. And they're beautiful, but they're much more beautiful in context of where they live. Yeah?
You talked about how they tag some of the snakes on the belly, but then if they shed like multiple times a year, how do you recognize this?
Well, what you do is when you cut it into they're shedding their epidermis. Okay, they're shedding their outer layer of skin. You're cutting into their dermal layer, and you're leaving a permanent scar. And that scar can be red in the shed skin. Yeah?
Do the patterns on the back of the snake, are they unique to the snake?
Yep. I know biologists who never touch the snakes that photograph them, like Gil was photographing birds, and they have a catalog of pictures, and they can recognize the snakes by their base color and banding patterns, and they know they're snakes. And they never have to handle them. So their snakes behave like they historically behaved. The snakes, remember the snake under the boot? Those snakes are really spooky. If they feel the vibration of a person, they retreat because they get handled and get cut up and they react like you're a predator. The places I work that I've taken my boys, as well as Miss Kornfeld, and her husband Amos, those snakes don't get handled, so they're just out in the open. You know, I've seen 20 of them laid across the rocks. They aren't retreating, because they don't consider us a threat. Yeah?
How do you think we can end the Texas Roundup?
Education. Yeah, my bottom line feeling as a naturalist is that you only protect what you like. And you're only going to love something if you learn about it. So people have to be educated about what rattlesnakes are and what they aren't, and then the roundups will probably get stopped. Certainly, a lot of them. Georgia stopped their roundups. Pennsylvania used to have 14 roundups. Now it only has 4, and you aren't allowed to catch more than one timber rattlesnake, and it can only be a male, can't be a pregnant female, and you have to return it after the roundup to where you caught it. So that's changed, and that's happened in the last 20 years. Texas, well, you've seen the Republican debates. You've seen the senator and the governor. But that'll change, I think. You know, if enough people get fascinated by them, they won't tolerate it. Like I said, you can't do that with any other animal. You couldn't possibly get away with that doing that with bluebirds.